2000 AD, 40 years of Thrill Power Festival. Editors reunited. Borag Thung, Earthlitz, and welcome to a supplemental episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast. At the beginning of February, we had a fantastically successful 40th anniversary event, and it was an incredible day. Over 1,000 Squatstick Thargo, over 100 creators, all crammed into the Novotel in Hammersmith in London for a day of panels and signings and sketchings and just general fun. And all the feedback we've had has been absolutely wonderful. So thank you to everybody who came. Now, we appreciate that not everybody could get tickets, so we thought we would bring the event to you. So in between episodes of the 2000 AD Thrillcast, we're going to be bringing you panels recorded at the 40 years of Thrill Power Festival. And we're down to the final one, which is a biggie. It's Editors Reunited with Matt Smith, Andy Diggle, Steve McManus, and Richard Burton, with an impromptu contribution from Jack Adrian, aka Chris Lauder, who was in the audience and very kindly added his weight to what was a real highlight of the festival for us, because from deadlines to, you know, dealing with creators, it's really the editors who are the behind the scenes droids who make sure that 2000 AD lands on your doormat or on your newsagent's shelf every week. And for the first time, these four iconic editors came together on one panel to talk about their experience of being at the helm of the galaxy's greatest comic. Your host for this final panel from 40 years of Thrill Power Festival is Matt Smith himself.
Welcome to the last panel of the day, which is Editors Reunited, which we find every freelancer's worst nightmare. Four editors all together. On the far left, we have Steve McManus. Next to him, we have Richard Burton. Next to me, we have Andy Diggle. So I'm going to basically chat about how we got into 2000 AD and what it was like. Okay, right, Steve, I'll start with you as you're the earliest editor. Was comics something you ever imagined getting into? Was it something you really wanted to get into?
No, as I say in the book, I loved comics as a kid. I read Valiant for a brief period. I was a DC Comics collector. But when I found myself in a publishing house that did comics, I said, I want to work on the football magazine shoot. And when they said no, I found myself by chance on a comic, and I thought, well, I'll just stay here and then maybe later on transfer back to shoot when I've killed their sub-editor. You know? So that's how I got into comics, because through mistake, not a desire. I wasn't a huge fan in terms of when I was an adult. That's it, yeah.
Can I just ask, how many people here have read Steve's memoir, The Mighty One? So kind of...
Oh, not too many, then. No.
But, I mean, why you editing through the 2000 AD, did you ever think, I want to get out of some of this and do, like, go back to football magazine, or did...
Never. After the first week, working as a sub-editor on Valiant comic, I knew that this was where I wanted to spend my time, just seeing original artwork come into the office and the scripts and the passion and seeing the printed product each week was, I think, what's the American say, a slam dunk. It just had me in its grip. It's so nice to see every 7 days something you've worked on. That's such a, it's almost like a habit, you know, a drug. You can't get off it. That's the answer.
All right. So, Richard, you came into 2000 AD while Steve was editor. You were the sub-editor.
Oh, yeah, you were.
you started sort of on the fan fringe, is that right? Because you started the Eagle Awards with...
Unlike Steve, my passion was to get into comics. When I sort of started work, there was no route I could see into it, so I actually went on and opted in photography for a while. Then I got into fandom, as it was at the time. That was all based around American comics. And I started running my own fanzine called Comic Media News. I don't know if anyone remembers it. That opened all sorts of doors, and I started professionally with Marvel Comics UK. At the time, the legendary Des Skinner was in charge. And we started doing new material on Marvel properties like Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., Hulk, all that sort of stuff. That lasted for about 3 months for many reasons, mostly Des Skin. And I was just sheer luck the time I left Marvel, a position opened up at IPC, but it wasn't on 2000 AD. It was on a new launch called Tornado. So I went in on that as sub-editor on Tornado and sort of tried, my goal was 2000 AD, which I had kept in touch with all through its genesis, because I had people, friends of mine, I mean, people that worked on my fanzine, people like Dave Gibbons and Brian Bolland, got jobs on 2000 AD, and I thought, this is something I want to do. Right. It's the first time I could see a British comic doing the sort of stuff I enjoyed in American comics. And so I had to serve my apprenticeship, as it were, first on Tornado, then on Tiger, for goodness sake. I don't like sports. So putting me on a sports comic was not a good idea. And just again, through sheer luck, more than anything, Alan Grant was leaving to go freelance, and I stepped into his shoes as sub on 2000 AD.
What year was that?
78.
So even sort of then, you could see that 2000 AD was kind of like a step apart from the other comics that were...
Oh, absolutely. As I said, you know, when I realised what was happening, when I heard about the style it was going to take, and I mean, a lot of it came through Action, though, didn't it? Because Action sort of paved the way. You know, using dynamic images, using big frames, big panels on a page, and really, yeah, I'd say it the American way, but there's the sort of style I was more familiar with, right, with American comics, but with the important British angle. And as I say, it was just like, this is going to be something big, and I want to be part of it. But it took a little while, but I eventually got onto it.
And you became editor around just after Prog 500, is that
right? Yeah, it's a bit of a patchwork. I mean, worked with Steve for many years. Then I went off and did something with a computer magazine, and I came back. And then Steve went off on his sabbatical, yeah, 3 months, went off, took himself off, and left me in charge of the baby. So... And when you came back, you wanted to start your own group, very much with new titles, new ideas. So then I was made full editor on 2000 AD. Right. Took it from there.
Cool. And then, I mean, that was presumably something you'd wanted to do for
years. Of course, yeah. The special thing about 2000 AD is you didn't... I mean, as Steve has mentioned, the terms in those days were editor and sub-editor. Now, sub-editor, to me, always sounds like saying subhuman or something. So really... sub-editor as an assistant editor, because on each comic there was two editorial staff and two art staff. Steve and myself, obviously editorial, and we had an art editor, and he had an assistant as well. And it was a team. I mean, the whole point of 2000 is always, through the years I was involved with it, it was a team effort. Everybody involved with the comic had an input into it, and I think it grew strong because of that. We had so many diverse opinions and ideas for new stories. So, it was just something I knew I wanted to be on, and something that was going to just make a difference.
Cool. Andy, did you have a publishing background before you started?
No, I didn't really. I'd been a sort of 2000 AD fan since, I think, Prog 210, Brian Bolland Freeze Dread cover, which kind of basically changed the course of my life from the age of 10 onwards. But I'd studied comics at uni. Did my dissertation on them, but I hadn't, and I'd sort of done, you know, worked in comic shops and blah, 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 but not in terms of publishing, no. But I think that I just managed to blag my way in by bullshitting Steve, basically, I think, and David.
So you were assistant to David.
David, are you here? There he is, David Bishop at the back. Hello, David.
Hello, David.
I heard through a friend of a friend that they might be an editorial, like, office. It's not even sub-editor, was it? It was, like, editorial assistant. It was not really much of a story. I applied for the job and I ended up getting it. And sort of worked my way up from there, really. But it was quite a rapid ascent. It was slightly, my head sort of spanned slightly because I started off as the guy sort of doing the photocopying. And then, you know, a couple of years later, I was the editor.
Yeah.
So I sort of managed to blag my way through the fact that I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. But I think it was the fact that I felt like I knew... I had strong feelings whether or not I was right or wrong, but I had strong feelings about the way I thought 2080 should be, and a strong sense of what should and shouldn't be in the comic. So for better or worse,
I remember interviewing Andy with David, and Andy came in, and you had it all, and you said, "Oh, I've got my own website I designed," and I thought, "Whoa, this guy knows what he's doing." Cause this was, and then I thought, "I'm going to catch him out," and I said to Andy, "So go on then, tell me what Preacher's about." He told me the whole thing in 25 words. And I think David probably had similar trick questions, but when at the end of it, Andy was a shoo-in, I think.
So to add on what Andy said about having strong feelings of what 2008 is, what do you think the role of editor of 2008 is? Are you a shepherd, basically corralling these pages every week? Or do you feel you should put your stamp on the comic? Do you think it's up to you to guide the writers and artists on what they do?
Well, I can only speak for my time there. It was so the notion of editor changes in terms of input or output or not touching at all kind of thing. At the time I was editor, it was more like production editor, just getting all this talent to the printers every 7 days. That was the big thing. If you didn't get the comic to the printers on that day, you're in trouble. As simple as that. So it took a while for me to get the hang of that process before then you could get some air and say, well, now we can begin to plan the year's issues. And this is where Judge Jeff is going to go and such, as I describe in the book. You're looking for your mojo, the comics mojo, and that took 3 years to go. So I would say, Matt, at the end of the day, kind of shepherd.
Richard, when you became editor, did you have strong ideas of what you wanted to do with the comic?
I can't remember any sort of strong ideas at the time. It was already starting to take directions I hoped it would go into. But I sort of could see the whole point was 2008 tapped into a rich vein of British comic talent, which literally until that moment had been undiscovered. It was known by fandom, but it was not known by the mass readership. And there were so many people just suddenly almost coming out of the woodwork that had never done comics before in Britain, that it was just a fascinating time to watch. I mean, in terms of what an editor does, I mean, I would describe more as a traffic manager, literally trafficking pages. And Steve said, we're the buffer between the creators and the management. The management really have got no idea what's going on the comic. They're just looking at the bottom line all the time. Is it selling enough copies each week? Are we making a profit? Okay, let's carry on.
Yes.
So we had to sort of manage that, their expectations, and also at the same time play nursemaid sometimes to a lot of creators to get them to do the best possible work that would bring the readers into the comic and get that comic, as Steve says, to press every week without fail. Otherwise, we were out.
Because Steve, you used to say you used to work week by week. The artist used to deliver the artwork the day it was due to go to the printers. Now, Richard, when you became editor, 2000, it was kind of at a crossroads where it was bringing more colour artwork, which obviously took longer. Did that bring its own challenges? I mean,
absolutely. I mean, you know, a good point. I mean, when I joined 2008, it was very much traditional British comic of colour covers and centre spread, and everything else was in mono, and it was printed on the worst possible, the cheapest paper you could find. It almost fell apart when you sort of, you know, opened it up. And again, as we got up, yes, there's sort of slowly the company began to realise they got something a bit different on their hands and started, thank goodness, to spend a bit of money on us. And one of the things was colour.
Wang Egmont bought it. They invested.
Absolutely. Yeah, we had a very good MD at the time called John Davidge, who actually believed in the comic, which was very rare. We didn't have that in the early days at all. And so we started to produce a comic that looked the part, I thought. It had color covers, color interiors. And so, yes, in answer to your question, yes, of course. I mean, there was another stage now. We had to get the artist to color the strip as well as supply the line work. So it took time. We had to build that into the schedule. And again, some people could touch it like a duck to water. Others, you know, sort of floundered a bit for a while, but eventually came on board. I mean, Simon Business is a great example. I always mentioned is Simon, sadly, was, well, not sadly, but he was one of our first artists to draw in colour. And I think he did earlier, admitted on the panel earlier, that was his baptism of fire, drawing in colour. And he had to do a lot of experimentation. I mean, we used to get the artwork in, but clearly he'd laid colour on colour on colour on colour. We had this, like, brown soup going across the page. And we had to somehow scan that in and make sure it printed okay on the page and everything. So it was a learning experience for all of us, but I think it paid off and made the comic that much better.
Yeah. And Andy, you became editor as Rebellion bought the comic. This was a new era for 2000 AD. What did you want to do for the comic? Where did you want to take it?
I wanted it to not get cancelled, I think, was my main my main priority. There'd been a certain amount of anxiety over the end of the tenure at Egmont, where, you know, there was a sense that they didn't really know what to do with it, they didn't particularly want it. Egmont had bought a bunch of Disney titles from, who was it from? Was it IPC, I guess?
Robert Maxwell.
They won the license.
Whoever it was, anyway. But yeah, but 2000 was part of this bundle and they didn't really want it and it didn't really fit in. No, and, exactly. And the sales had been gradually trickling down steadily for years. And it was, you know, and it's scary and I loved the comic, but it just, you know, just looking at the sales, it was clear that, like, you know, every week somebody decides they don't want to read this anymore. So my absolute priority was like, okay, I need to try and make the comic so good that nobody's ever going to feel that they don't need to know what happens next, you know. So yeah, that was the main thing for me. And when Rebellion bought it, I mean, the Kingsley brothers were very much kind of like, we don't want to rock the boat. Just, you know, keep doing what you're doing. You know, there wasn't any major shifts in. They didn't tell us what to, you know, any sense of like what kind of material to put in there. What I was trying to do in terms of the stories was, you know, try and get the mix of the best of the old stuff and the best of the new stuff, the best popular old characters and create new characters. But the same with creators, you know, reach out to people who hadn't worked at 2000 for years. Like I reached out to Colin Wilson and Jesus Redondo and Steve Moore and people like this. But also trying to develop new talent, you know, like from the slush pile, like Fraser Irving and Jark and all the rest of it. Just try and make it good, I guess. You know, it's not particularly, you know, like a vision thing, but...
So, what makes a good 2000 AD story? What?
Well, the editor, Max.
I'm asking the past editors. So, for a bit
I
of advice,
we should be asking you questions.
when you look at a 2000 AD story, what do you think has got that? What's it got that's got that mojo that 2000 AD needs?
Can you ask Andy first?
All right, and.
Thrill power. Yeah, you can tell. You can say you just put your hand over it like that. I remember, when I first time I brought Jock. Is Jock here? Are you here, mate? No, I brought him to the editorial office, and we had a big pile in one of the art drawers. We had a big pile of Henry Flint's ABC Warriors artwork. You know, we just kind of opened the drawer and looked at all the stuff. It's like you can put your hand over it, you can actually feel the thrill power coming off it. You know, highly concentrated. No, you know it when you see it, I think. And sometimes you'll see something and go, yeah, that's not really 2000 AD. But I think, but that's probably a different feeling for everybody. You probably have different opinions on that than me. But I guess that's part of the editorial thing. It's just your taste, I guess, or lack thereof.
I'd like to throw that question on its head a bit and say, what makes a good issue of 2000 AD or a good product of 2000? That's it. I mean, the thing when I was, well, right from days joined Steve, I always thought 2000 was special because you had six different stories every week. Now, those six stories may not appeal to everybody, but it gives enough there for people to come in from quite a young age and enjoy stories meant to them, like Road Trooper was written for a younger audience. And then they can progress up through the various different stories, through Dread, through Slain, to, you know, to quite adult themes. And I think we were lucky to be able to do that. And it gave a, what I call, what was a very accessible comic. And I think any issue that that took somebody from one level to another was a success. And that's what I think helped the comic for most of its life.
Yeah. I mean, what's a personal high point for you as editor? What story did you publish that you thought
is your favourite children's story question? It's difficult. I mean, there's so many. We had fun. I mean, we did stuff that we liked. We would sit around literally laughing some days, just saying, you know, this is, we can't believe we're getting paid for this sort of thing. Other days were quite different, but as I say, you know, everything was special. I mean, you know, Dread was always one of my constant joys because Wagner was just so good at combining so many different layers of a story, from out and out action and adventure through to quite black humour and satire that only an older audience would get. I mean, I take my hat off to John for being able to sort of do all that. And so we were able to have a lot of fun with Dread and different things. We did Dead Man, which was great fun because nobody knew who the Dead Man was. You know, for a long time, we were dropping hints left, right, and centre, but nobody picked it up. So, and I liked the fact we took chances. We did Zenith. I mean, one day somebody said, we should do a superhero story. We should do it the 2000 AD way. And we talked to Grant and we talked to Steve Yeol, and suddenly Zenith was born. And so that was another act. But there are just so many, Dior and Quinch, you know, all these characters that, I mean, often as not, we would sit in an office, somebody would come in one day and say, how about this idea? And we'd say, wow, we never thought of that. Yeah, go ahead and do it.
Nice.
So, you know, it can be so many things.
Yeah. Did you have a level of management above you, like Steve used to have, that was checking each issue?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
A whole multi-level of management above us. I mean, we had a managing editor. What was Gil? Who was managing it? Group editor, managing editor, publisher. I mean, when we were part of IPC, we were part of a massive publishing operation that didn't do just comics, but some of the best-selling magazines of the day. You know.
And there was a bit of mafia involved in these layers. Of,
oh, yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. Management, because say you were doing an annual and you were given £5,000 to commission the art and the scripts. Fair enough.
It can be told, yeah.
And then they'd say, but before you commission anything, you're going to pay me £125 as the group editor, you're going to pay the managing editor £200, and the managing director's going to get £500. So suddenly your big budget eviscerated, and that's how they got around pay rises. You just had to, and that you got to remember, Chris, I think it's bearing me out here, and this is where if you think when sorry Matt, I'm not looking at you.
No.
In those days they would do, Fleetway would publish something like 20 or 30 annuals, so you're the group editor sitting there getting 20 times 125 each year.
For doing nothing.
It was scandalous. Now looking back, but at the time you just thought, all right, you know.
Well, if you queried what it was for, you were very soon made to know that you should not ask such those questions.
Yeah.
So, Steve said it. I mean, annuals were probably one of the things that were done as a last resort for a lot of comics. Is basically we've got this book to fill with with stuff, and don't really mind what it is. It's probably going to be old strips of red line around the office for years. Throwing a few puzzles, a couple of tech stories, and chuck it out for Christmas. They'll buy it anyway.
Well, the parents would, you see. This
yeah,
is
that's
thing.
Right.
As I mentioned in my book, well, I won't go any further because those who bought it know, and those who haven't will want to read it.
We had, we used to, I mean, in our day, we had a lot of if you like, celebs coming up to the office from time to time. We had film crews coming up all the time, TV companies coming in, shooting in the office. Various shows like The Tube and what else was it we have? With
Six o'clock show, The Tube, Bob Geldof.
Oh, that's my story. I was going to say, yeah.
This is your story. Yeah. I actually tell it in the book, so I'm sorry.
This is from me. I don't have a book at the moment. So, we had Paula Yates come into the office, who then was Bob Geldof's girlfriend, and she was doing all the interviews, and we had the latest annuals like displayed on a side shelf, and she had the classic lines is, "Oh, can I have one of those shiny books for me boyfriend?" From thereafter, annuals were shiny books. So, but we tried to make sure that at least the annual, as far as we could, you know, match the quality of the prog. We tried to get the best stories, the best artists, best writers, as much as we could. In the early days, you couldn't, because there was a rule at IPC that no, you couldn't reprint any material was less than 5 years old. So that meant, you know, the early 2000 annuals, by definition, couldn't have 2008 material in them. So then we would just try and find the best of the archive stuff.
Exactly. What was the question?
I mentioned kind of the level of management above you that you had to
go. Sorry, I interrupt.
I mean, did you publish anything that you got into trouble for, or that you've got the red line across that you couldn't get away with?
The only one I remember was the dread story with all the trademark characters in Ronald McDonald and Burger because King, Burger Wars.
As written by Chris.
Yeah.
No, John wrote Burger Wars.
Yeah, Mike Lake came up with the Alka-Seltzer kit. The whole point about that was that when I was talking to Kelvin, Kelvin Gosnell rang me up and said, "We need a dread. We need a two-part dread. Pat's slowing down, Mike's slowing down, Bolland's slowing down, and we need something." And he said, "I've got John to do a couple of pull-ins, and they've been done." So I said, "Okay, well, I'll do that." Anyway, I was doing it with Bolland, and Bolland rang up in a bit of a. We got all these. I wanted to use Mr. Therm. As I think I said in my intro, we couldn't find a reference for Mr. Therm. It's the Gas Council of 1953 or something. You can tell my vintage. And we had the Alka-Seltzer kid, which, as I said, was dreamed up. He rang me up one day and said, "Why don't you use the Alka-Seltzer kid?" I wanted to get all these American-style things. And Bolland liked drawing American-style stuff. But he rang me up in a terrible fright and said, "Look, I hope you won't mind." He said, "I've changed the main villain, the mad villain, Dr. whatever his name is, into Colonel Sanders." I said, "No, I don't mind. That's great. That's fine." And the joke was that it was that jolly green sodding giant who took us to, or tried to take us to court. KFC didn't do a thing. That's KFC right. could have bankrupted 2000 AD. And I'm staggered they never came up with that, because there was this Dr. Gribbin, who was the most fiendish, you know, guy, shooting people, shooting flying Michelin men and all that sort of stuff. But that was anyway. That was the main point of the story was that I got it wrong. Was that it was Mike Lake who came up, not Brian Bolland, with the Alka-Seltzer kid. That's my thank you very much.
Can I just go back to your question for a second? I would say you asked about whether we had any red line from management. I mean, quite the opposite. They didn't even read our stuff. I've got a classic memo from John Sanders, who used to be the managing director of the comics group when we were part of IPC, used to rule the place by fear. Classic memo that said one day, "Why isn't Judge Dredd in 2000 AD anymore?" And we sort of blinked and who's that, you know? And it just been that like one prog some months before, I think we had to take Dredd out just for 1 week. There was some problem with this dress story. And I think that's the only one he'd seen that had been like months ago. And he seemed to think that we'd taken the character out forever. So, as I say, I don't really think they took much notice of what we were doing.
No,
well, they basically didn't understand what we were doing, more importantly.
Yeah. I mean, you had a similar experience at Egmont, Andy. The marketing manager there made a similar comment about Johnny Alpha.
Yeah, it was Doug Pocock, the marketing manager, who was... yeah, that guy. Yeah, he... there was a picture of Johnny Alpha on my computer screen. Like a big blow-up headshot, Carlos. And Doug Pocock, who was the editor's line manager, I believe, said, "Who's that? Is that Dredd's new uniform?" And it's like, I said to him, perhaps like rather too tartly, "No, it's the second most popular character in your comic, Doug." But yeah, like they were just completely clueless. And I remember, they didn't get it. Like David and I would both, you know, try and explain to them that, you know, people buy this for good stories and art, not because they want a little plastic toy sellotape to the front. So they then, spent thousands of pounds commissioning this market research company to find out why people read 2080. And it turns out they bought it because they wanted good stories and art. I was like, well, just listen to us. You're going to save yourself £10,000.
So, I mean, does an editor then have to be a fan? Do you have to love the comic to edit it? It becomes more than just a job. It becomes sort of like a vocation.
I think every editor has a passion to be an editor, whether it's The Sporting Life or the New York Times, or as Richard said, he started out with Comic Media News. That's the passion. So it starts at home. And that doesn't mean to say you have to love the title you're on, but you have a passion for editing. And if you don't like the title you're on, you still get a kick out of getting it out and getting the best stuff. And if you're lucky enough to have a passion for it, then it's like you're in bed with the most beautiful person in the world.
Are you saying that you sleep with your progs?
Especially Durham.
I think... probably passionate. I think if you're professional about it. I mean, yes. I mean, as I said, when I first got into comics, I was a fan. Come from a fandom background, and I had a fandom, you know, precepts of what, you know, the whole thing was about and what we should be. But that was very quickly knocked out of me by, you know, just as Steve said, the need to get a copy, get an issue out every single week without fail. And very soon, you have to be professional. Yes, of course you have to be enthusiastic about what you print, but you've got to make sure that the quality is there and you deliver the best possible comic you can. And more importantly, keep the sales figures up.
So I'll just, one last question before I open it out to the audience if they've got any questions. Do you miss it? Do you miss editing 2000 AD?
Me?
Well, all of you.
Oh, God. Well, I stopped editing it 500, which I think is about 40 years ago. So it's a high pressure job. It's something I think you can do for about 5 years before you freak out. Matt's been doing it now for how many years?
15.
To be fair, Matt has freaked out.
Yes.
We worked that one out beforehand, you know, the old handoff, as they say in American football. Yeah, actually, that was spontaneous. I loved it for the 8 years I was there. I don't miss it in the sense that you don't miss a partner you've broken up with. That was then. This is now. You have fond memories of them, but you can't go back there. No one gets back to that. And so you move forward in your life and you write a book that gets quite well received.
Definitely don't read this book now. No, I don't think so. I mean, that was then, this is now. What I like about, what I've always been grateful to 2000 years about is the doors it opened up afterwards. And I mean, it meant I was able to go on to produce a comic of my own called Sonic the Comic, which I used a lot of the ideas I had in 2000 AD. And it seemed to work, and so much so that last August we had a gathering for Sonic the Games 25th anniversary. And loads of people came along who read the comic. And, you know, it was just like this event, really, this way. But it's smaller, obviously. But and other magazines that came along afterwards. So as Steve eloquently says, yes, it was fabulous when we were doing it. Lot of work, a lot of late nights, a lot of pressure. But I think that was then, this is now.
Nandy, you've made the move into being a freelance writer, but which
I thoroughly enjoy.
You could never see yourself going back to editing somebody else's work.
There isn't enough money in the world. it was like you said, it is a very high pressure job, and it's quite. I found it quite stressful, to be honest. I probably made it more stressful than I needed to, so got myself to blame for that. I love writing, and it's kind of like the weekly comics, like a relentless machine. You got to keep feeding the machine, and like you can't. There's only so long you can keep doing. How you do it, I don't know.
Yeah.
I would have burned out, I think, if I'd stuck around. But you know, plus I always wanted to write anyway, you know, and I think that I wouldn't really have been true to myself if I hadn't gone and written my own stories.
Cool. Okay, so we got about. I love it. I wouldn't still be here if I didn't. But it gets a bit production line. Every week, 32 pages has to be fed into the machine. But you can't help not get excited by new pages of artwork coming in, new scripts coming in. You know, email pings with another page from an artist, and you still get that thrill of seeing something being created.
What's email?
Yeah, I was about to say we had letters. By the bag, like, by the sackful, and everyone had to be opened.
40th anniversary prog on sale 22nd of February. Just to get my plug in.
That's my birthday. And your birthday.
Yeah, 22nd of February is mine and Steve's birthday as well. So clearly, this is fated.
has anyone in the audience got any questions for ex editors? I've got a few. I'll ask you first.
What is the secret to getting pages in on time from freelancers?
Torture, pain, anything. Take your pick.
Crying sometimes helps. Crying down the phone at them.
Anything you can do, any emotion you can bring to bear on them.
Oh, blackmail works as well.
Yeah. There's a lot of blackmail, you know. Yeah. It's impossible. Richard mentioned earlier about some artists who are so good. I think Richard coined the term commission and forget. And that, like, fire and forget, you had no worries. Massimo Bernardinelli was one of those who just got the work in, bang on time. So that bought you time to, as you say, cajole, chase, help the other artists to get their work in. It didn't always work. And I won't mention my stories about that.
So a question over there.
Is the pub as important as it used to be?
Is the pub?
The pub. I've only been to Matt's office once, but the first thing he did was take me to the pub. So.
But yeah, there was the big kind of social gathering around the pool table. Of a Friday when all the artists used to come in with their artwork. I mean that's kind of sort of died away a little bit. Is in that so many kind of writers and artists scattered to the wind kind of thing. It all comes via email.
Those were good days. Camden Town.
I was about to say with us in Camden Town, it was Rose and Jack's.
Yes, what was Rose and Jack's?
Cafe. I mean, it's the place we used to go for lunch every day, and the number of series ideas that came out of lunches were just amazing. So,
yeah. Igor Goldkind.
Very boring, but we did most of ours in a cafe.
Then I took them all to the pub afterwards. And Igor Goldkind, anyone know that name? Yeah. He would always have two hard-boiled eggs sitting opposite Richard. And then in the evening, he and I would go out and... In the morning, Igor might come in with a big black eye, and I'd say, "What happened to you, dude?" Oh,
Right, it's not Scottish, but that's my American accent. So they were strange days.
We never find out how he got the black eye.
There are stories. I think David Bishop knows more than me.
Yes.
Having been in charge of 2008 for so long between all of you, what do you think is the influence the magazine has had on the wider UK culture? Or is that something that it's possible to identify?
Well, for me, it's coming to something like this. I mean, who would have thought? You know, I mean, we knew we had something special on our hands, but 40 years later, come on. As people like yourselves, you know, just coming up to us and saying, thank you. Yeah, you did something we really enjoyed and made a difference to our lives, or we did this. You know, it's just that sort of thing. So, yeah, you know, we just... It's hard at the time when you're, as you say, trying to get the issues out the door. The last thing you really think about is the sort of reaction you get from the readers. Well, I mean, going back to what I was saying about our pre-email days, I mean, we would gauge reaction by two things. First, like the number of letters and drawings we had in. And secondly, did anybody remember the little coupon in the prog at the back? You'd be amazed how many people cut that out and sent it in with their listing their three favourite stories for that week. And we used to put it onto a graph in the office and chart the success of the stories.
Strange how they all came from Colchester.
Any other questions?
You've all spoken about the sort of pressures of production and feeding the machine and so on, but what about creative editorial decisions? Death of Johnny Alpha, Judgment Day, Day of Chaos, all this, the sort of really important direction stuff. To what extent did you all get involved in that?
Well, of it's like writer-led, really. I mean, in terms of Day of Chaos, that's purely John saying, I've got this idea. I think it started with him saying, I've got this idea about a Psy Cadet having a vision of something terrible happening on the mayoral elections. And it just grew from there. And, I had no idea where it was going to go. It just the script came in and everything, it seemed to be getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's my job was kind of like finding out when I could schedule this thing and sorting the artists out and who was going to draw it. But I mean, as far as Dread goes with John's very much the one who wants to, you know, where he wants to take the character. And if he doesn't want to do something, he doesn't do it. I couldn't come up to him and say, can you make Dread do this or take the story in this direction? If he's not interested, then he won't do it. So it's very much a creator led, I'd say.
Well, with me, if you want to talk about Johnny Alpha, blame it on me. There was a time when we were seeing from the reaction to the strip that it wasn't doing as well as it had. And I felt there needed to be something to shake it up and do something. So I thought, as the strip was about the strontium dogs, plural, maybe we could do without one of them for a while. At the time, it was like, yeah, going to kill him off, but we could always bring him back again later on. DC and Marvel do that all the time now. It wasn't like me just saying, yes, this is what we're going to do. I rang up Alan Grant, and we had a long conversation on the phone. And you know, he was behind it. He went along with it. And so that's what we did.
I wrote an angry letter to Tharg when you killed off Johnny Alpha.
So which creators from each other's eras would you have liked to have worked with?
I'll say I'll have to pass on that one because I'm not quite sure who's around.
I would say Jock. I'd like to work with Andy, actually, but I wasn't.
Meet me in the pub after.
I'm a big fan of Dom Reardon, too. Warren Police. Do you know Warren Police? I'm so sad that he never found a niche in 2000 AD. And you want to work with everyone, I guess, but there's only 32 pages and so much stock that you're allowed to accumulate. This was a real Richard Broke, and he accumulated something like £500,000, which solved the deadline problem in one way.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably luxury we had then, which we probably wouldn't have now, is that we had a very benevolent management team who sort of understood that to get the best. At that, definitely, that time, we were competing with the Americans. 2000 started to become so popular that the headhunters were coming over and snatching away our best talent. And so we still wanted to use them, but the only way we could do it was to sort of work with them and sort of what their schedules were. So if we could say to the likes of Bolland or Gibbons, yes, please do this, but we'll wait for you. We'll just do it when you can, and we'll keep it until we've got enough material to run. So, so yes, I'm very thankful for that. The management would went along with that.
As far as creators for from the earlier era, so it would be nice to just be able to go to Alan Moore and say, "Can you write me a Future Shock? I've got this idea for about an alien series. Go, can you go off and write it?" And he'll you'll come back with a script that. I'd like to be able to have done that.
He was a sweetheart. You could ring him up on Sunday and he'd say, all right, Steve, yeah, sure. And sweetest guy I'd ever known in that sense.
And that's Steve, sorry, I was going to say Steve Dillon was another one that I was hankering to get back into 2000 AD ever since I've been editor. And I mean, we nearly got it and sadly didn't.
Yeah. That was going to be my answer, Steve Dillon. Like his art was on the back cover of the first issue I ever bought, and I cut the back cover off and stuck it on my bedroom wall. My brother made me sellotape it back on again for defacing his prog. But no, I've been a huge Steve Dillon fan ever since then, and yeah, it was so sad that he passed away recently.
I mean, that was what a talent that guy was. I mean, I sort of claimed discovery of him because I met him in a comic shop when he was 16, and even then I saw he was 20. And he was so mature and his stuff was so good that that was even before 2000, I was working for Marvel UK. We were just about to start the new stuff, so I thought he would be ideal for Nick Fury and some of the other stuff we were doing. So, yeah.
Is there any other questions?
Thanks. Hi, Stephen Watson, first time questioner, long time reader. First, I'd like to thank for a great day today for all your efforts in organising things. It's been a great success. My question to the panel is, why haven't any of you bastards ever published one of my stories? I've not written many. More to the point, could you give us an idea of your approach and attitude towards the slush pile, which you often hear about?
Slush pile? Do we have one?
I'm afraid it went straight in my bottom drawer. And it grew and grew and grew. And then one day, when everyone had gone home, I got a black bag and put it in the bin.
Was that in the book too?
Didn't it become Alan Grant's job to go through the...
That bit's in the book, yeah. So then when Alan came, thank God, he meticulously went through every single... and wrote back to all these people, one of whom was a certain Mr. Moore from Northampton.
I found that's a good point. You by definition had to work late some nights. I remember before I joined 2000, I used to come down. We were on the floor above, I think, coming down. And Alan Grant was sitting alone in the 2000 AD office, tapping away at the typewriter, corresponding with all these people. So, yeah, he really took his job seriously.
I mean, to be fair to me, so you don't all go out and say, that bastard. if I'd answered every single unsolicited piece of work, I think is the word, not smush pile, then the comic would have something. I couldn't do both jobs. So that's why it had to be, you know, kill your babies, I think is an expression awful marketing people use. And someone had to die in that office, and it wasn't going to be the John Wagner script, was it?
I think the submissions pile was one of the first things David had me do when I started as his assistant. It had been sort of growing and growing in the corner. We had a big plans chest with all the artwork in it, and the slush pile, I think, was about 2 feet high by this point, and it was kind of close to becoming sentient at this point, so somebody needed to deal with it. And it's in terms of advice for people submitting stuff, obviously nowadays everything's done electronically. In those days, it's hard. It's easy for artists to get noticed because you can tell straight away as soon as you see the art, that guy can draw. So, like, you know, people like, you know, Jock, Fraser Irving, Ben Oliver, you know, these guys were just like clearly this guy can draw, give this guy a job, you know. With writing, it's much more difficult because, you know, having to read a script is much more time consuming to get a sense of whether this guy knows what he's doing. But now, because everything's electronic, a good piece of advice, I think, would be don't send big art files to editors, okay? Because they don't want to get their inbox clogged up with all this stuff that might have viruses on it or whatever. What you do is you just stick it online somewhere and send them a link. Or, you know, email them first, say, would it be okay if I sent you a link? So, yeah, because especially if they're trying to download their email on their phone over 3G and somebody's trying to send them a 20 megabyte art file or something. So, yeah, that's a no-no. Be good. You know, a lot of people you've got to get used to rejection as well. Because, you know, even if you do get into the comics industry, you will still face rejection your entire career. Everybody does. Everybody gets things knocked back. It's part of the job. So you have to sort of develop a thick skin, but treat it as training. Because, you know, the more you do, the more work you do, the better you'll get. So it's not really, the question isn't really, how do I get into the industry? The question is, how do I get, you know, good enough that the industry will come to me, I guess. Does that sound pretentious? Probably.
I mean, the slush pile or the submissions, the pile of unsolicited manuscripts and art submissions still exists. It's still on it's on my desk, and I admit it's low priority. I get round to it when things have slackened off, and we now have a period where the submission process closes. It's going to close on 1st of March, and then we'll reopen in September later this year. But that allows me to go through it without more submissions coming through every day, because at least a couple arrive every day and they get put in the pile, and the pile gets bigger and bigger and bigger until I get round to it.
Through the mail or electronic?
It's mostly through the mail, because I can't have submissions come through email, otherwise my inbox would just simply explode. So it has to be postal. Otherwise, I'd never get anything done. To echo something Andy said, yeah, about really having commitment to do it, you know, not sort of being knocked back if your story of art isn't accepted. Because I've had professional writers, not just comics writers, but TV writers, authors, who said, I'd love to work for 2000 AD. Can I send you a script? And I say, yeah, fine, I'll take a look. Either they send something, you reject it, and they never hear from them again, or they bottle it and never send it in. Yeah. And there's a lot of, you know, sort of these are quite big name writers who suddenly get the fear when it comes to writing for 2000 AD. And so if you are submitting work, then, you know, it takes some balls, and you have to, you know, but it's a lot of people don't go through with it, but it's important that you do if you want to write for 2000 AD. I think we need to wrap it up now. So thanks to Steve, Richard and Andy, and thank you for coming. Thank you.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that, Earthlitz. Sorry about any sound issues. This was, of course, being recorded in front of a live audience. So not everybody's microphone technique is perfect, but I hope you at least got the gist of this panel. An absolutely fascinating insight into the behind-the-scenes work that goes on in creating the galaxy's greatest comic. Join us next week for a regular episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast, and make sure you tune in 2 weeks' time for another amazing panel from the 40 years of Thrill Power Festival. Splundig Vertrig.
Dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10. And download DRM free copies from 2000adonline.com. Alert! Alert! Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2000 AD on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2000AD online and follow on Instagram at Insta2000AD. Program complete. Shutting down.